Good morning, everyone. Boker Tov. Welcome to Sunday Shul here at SPL, to the course, The Chronicles of the Apostles. And this is class number 49 in The Chronicles of the Apostles. And eventually today, hopefully, being that I don't have to preach or be worship leader in the 10:45 service, I can just keep going for a while. Maybe we'll get to the opening verse of chapter 15 of Acts today, but I do want to spend some time setting the context for Acts chapter 15, because I think that is very important for us to do on several levels, and I'll explain some of those as we go along. And so with that, let's get started with prayer, and then we will begin looking into what is known as the Jerusalem Council, is often what Acts 15 is kind of subtitled. But let's pray.
ברוך אתה אדוני אלוהינו מלך העולם אשר קדישנו במצוותיו וסיוונו לעסוק בדברי הדבר. Blessed Lord, since you have caused all holy scriptures to be written for our learning, grant that we would so hear them, read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest them, so that by patience and comfort of your holy word we would embrace and ever hold fast the blessed hope of everlasting life. And we pray these things through Jesus Christ, your Son, our Lord, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen.
So as we kind of prepare to look at Acts chapter 15, and again, what would be what has become known as the Jerusalem Council, I first want to spend some time looking at what I'll call the Sitzim Leben of the Jerusalem Council of Acts 15. Sitzim Leben is a German word that's kind of become idiomatic in biblical studies. It kind of just means literally the situation in life. But in more broader terms, it means the cultural context, the political context, the economic context, what all was going on in the contemporary society at a particular juncture in history that you are studying. And the reason I think this is important to do now, we've spent some time with Sitzim Leben at different places in the book of Acts and the Chronicles of the Apostles. But Acts chapter 15 is such a pivotal chapter, not only in the life of this early Jesus community, this first generation of Jesus followers after his ascension, but it also becomes pivotal in the early church and throughout Christian history and theology. In fact, it's still consulted regularly today with regards to certain theological issues, because it's the coming together of the apostles after the time of Jesus no longer being on earth to discuss what does it look like for this community of Jesus followers. And so it kind of gave the Jesus community defining characteristics, identity markers, all right? And so because of that, it's crucial. And so what I want us to remember now is that biblical events did not happen in a vacuum. And unfortunately, I think many times when we read the scriptures and the way that they're taught, because we hear a sermon on just 8 verses here and 12 verses there, or we have a Bible class that lasts for a few weeks on this section, that we just look at those texts and those verses in complete isolation. Not only in complete isolation from the rest of the testimony of Scripture in many times, but in complete isolation from world history, geopolitical history, what's going on in the world at the time. And so that's why I believe it's important for us to know how the people at that time, what they were being taught, what they were learning in synagogue, what they were learning from their religious leaders, what they understood, what they imagined. To kind of put it in perspective, think about if 500 years from now, an anthropologist or a group of sociologists or a group of archaeologists wanted to look back and study the year or the 2 years, 2017 and 2018, and they wanted to look at the United States culture in 2017 and 2018. You would expect them not just to simply isolate one thing or one person, but you would expect them to give you a panorama of the entire history. So you would expect them to include things like the hashtag MeToo movement. That's quite a big deal, right? That's a culture shift that we are currently living in. Our Black Lives Matter, that's important. That shaped all kinds of things. That shaped how we react, how we respond, how we talk, how we speak, how we do law enforcement. That's affected elections. It's a big thing. No matter where you end up on the political spectrum or on whose side you are on, it doesn't matter with regards to the importance of it in our culture. If you think it would be important looking back in this period to look at who our president was and how he came about being president and who he was running against and who preceded him. It was the first African-American president. All those things matter if you're going to try in 500 years from now to describe what did it mean to live in the year 2018. And so that's what I want to do before we actually look in verses in Acts chapter 15, is I want to look at what would be some of the things that was on everybody's radar. Whether you were a Roman citizen, pagan Caesar worshiper, a devout Orthodox Jew who did not accept Jesus as Messiah, to the first generation of Jesus followers. What's something that was on all of their radars, that they were all aware of, that they were all dealing with, that they were all discussing, that was all influencing and shaping their lives and their decisions and their reactions? What was going on then? And another kind of sub-theme on why this will be important is from Acts chapter 11 to Acts chapter 14, we saw how that kind of study of Scripture really helped us understand Galatians a little bit better, right? In the Epistle of Galatians and some of the things Paul was saying in Galatians and why he was saying those, and to give definition to terms like Judaizer and so forth. Well, setting the tone for Acts 15 will help us better understand the Epistle to the Romans. Because we're going to be talking about what's going on in Rome, in the Roman Empire, and so forth as we look at Acts chapter 15. And that'll help us understand Paul's words to those who are in Rome. Because as far as the New Testament is concerned, Paul never was in Rome. All right? He never makes it to Rome, at least as far as recorded biblical history has it, okay? Now, is there evidence that he gets there? Yeah, and we'll get to that eventually. But at the end of Acts, he's ready to set sail for Rome, and that kind of ends it. And even when he writes to the congregations in Rome, he hasn't really been there. He's writing to people he knows who he's sent there, all right? So let's kind of look at what's going on in the world at the time of Acts 15. So we're going to be looking basically in the years 44 through 49 of the Common Era, or AD, and looking at what shaped that, because as best we can tell, the Jerusalem Council is occurring around 49 to 50 in the Common Era. And as we get there, we'll unpack why we think that and know that. All right. So if we were living in the decade of the 40s, of the Common Era, what was the world like then? What was going on? Especially if you were living in the 40s in the area of Jerusalem and Syria and Galatia and Asia Minor and that part of the world, what was going on? So the recent events of 44 to 48. So while Paul and Barnabas journey through Cyprus, and they went up into Galatia. That's what we spent the last several weeks in class looking at. Things are still happening back in Judea. That is, life goes on even when you're not there. All right? So where we're going to be at trying to keep up in the class, kind of keep a mental head game. Everything we've talked about with regards to Paul's first journey up in Galatia and all that, we're kind of now going back and looking what was happening back in Jerusalem, why Paul was in Cyprus and traveling up and going through Galatia and doing all the things that he did that we talked about. What was going on back at the mothership? What was going back at the core, the root, the home of the Jesus community in Jerusalem? All right? Because life continued to go on there. Paul wasn't doing this in a vacuum. So Herod Agrippa died in 44 of the common era. And we've talked about Herod Agrippa's death in class. And when he passed away, the Jewish people had hoped that his son, known as Prince Agrippa II, would take over the throne as his father's successor. The Roman emperor at the time, Claudius, was inclined to actually do this. Claudius liked Agrippa II. Agrippa II, as we have talked about as well, was raised in the courts of Herod. So there was a connection. Claudius knew him, knew his family. He even owed his family a favor. But the emperor's advisors expressed doubts about appointing a 17-year-old. Agrippa II was 17. They expressed some doubts that he was probably inexperienced, especially to handle the tumultuous Jewish kind of kingdom and the things that those Jewish people do in Jerusalem come Passover time and so forth. So Claudius yielded to his advisors, and he decided to return Judea back to direct Roman control, and he sent a new procurator, a new kind of governor there, who was named Cuspius Fadus, who served in this role from 44 to 46. And again, why is this important? Well, the same reason it would be important again in 500 years to explain Donald Trump was the president of the United States and a little bit of what his personality was like to explain why some of the other things happened in the country and so forth, right? Who's leading matters, because it shapes people's reactions and responses. It stimulates things. It aggravates things. It does all kinds of things. It matters. Fadus immediately attempted to assert his power over the Jewish priesthood by seizing control of the high priest's vestments. And he placed them under guard in the fortress Antonia. For those who've been to Jerusalem and been blessed to go to Jerusalem, you probably visited the fortress Antonia or where it was located. Well, Fadus took all the priest vestments and everything that the priest would need in order to do the high priest job, and he put it under lock and key in the fortress Antonia, which overlooks the Temple Mount. This was in keeping with earlier Roman policy, and it basically required the priesthood to check out high priest garments like a person borrowing a book from the library. But what it did is it ensured Roman control. Not only Roman control of just being a reminder of you need to know who's in charge, because you can't even do your worship services unless Rome gives you permission to do your worship services. But it also ensured Rome to have control over the priesthood and the selection of the high priest. And this is one of the reasons why there were so many zealot Jewish movements, because the Torah is very specific on who can be a high priest, right? It has to be from a certain family line, and it has to be done in a very specific way. And Rome didn't pay attention to any of that. Rome just selected who it thought would best serve Rome's interest. And so a lot of the religious Jews of the time felt that the priesthood was invalid, and therefore the services were invalid, and the sacrifices were invalid, and everything going on the Temple Mount was invalid. And so many of them separated, and some moved to the Dead Sea area and kind of started their own little thing down there, trying to wait it out Others just separated. The Pharisees were largely in this movement where they didn't cut off the Temple Mount and the temple, but they were less inclined towards it. And instead, they viewed going back to before the way it was in the Torah where the priesthood was established, where the firstborn son was the priest of the family. And so kind of this is where a lot of the Sabbath rituals come on a Friday night evening, come from this period where the head of the house is kind of acting as the priest of his family. By the way, this is called the priesthood of Melchizedek. And this is why Jesus is of that priesthood, because Jesus is a firstborn son, and therefore he is a priest. But he's a priest not of the order of Aaron, which has its own establishment, but of the establishment that comes where the firstborn son is the priest. Okay? And so you have kind of this Rome pushing down its thumb again. You can even see this today in modern history. If you look at Israel and you have what's going on in Gaza and the revolts, in some ways you could just say, hey, those guys need to quit launching rockets and Israel will quit responding. What happens when you throw little bitty rockets at a guy that has really big rockets? Well, he throws really big rockets back at you, and it's a lot worse than your little rockets did. So quit throwing your little rockets. It could be easy to say that unless you were within Gaza and felt like you had no choice, that you could do nothing, that you were being completely oppressed, that you had absolutely no freedoms, and therefore your actions aren't the most logical. CNN last night ran a documentary on the year 1968. And when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, there were all kinds of looting and violence in the city, you know, and you logical from, you know, 50 years later, you'd want to say, how could you not know that's going to make things worse for you and in your case and so forth? They're not thinking logically. They're reacting to hardships and so forth. And so when Rome starts doing this kind of thing, 44 through 48 AD, you can expect things to start to fester and build up and lead to one of those explosions at a Passover that have happened before, including during the time of Jesus and the time he was in Jerusalem on a specific Passover. And we're going to learn about one another Passover explosion that happens in 49 AD, all because Cuspius Fadus really begins to try to assert Roman dominance over the Jewish people. Now, Agrippa II hears about this. And he intercedes, and he goes directly to Claudius, who is a family friend. He asks Claudius to reconsider this policy. Claudius agrees. He transferred political control of the Temple Mount and the temple, its treasury, and the custody of the sacred garments to King Herod of Chalcis, another Herod. And this was Agrippa II's uncle, as well as the husband of his sister Bernice. You may remember Bernice. Bernice is going to be twice widowed by the time she's like 22. All right. Bernice, you know, might have the reputation of a black widow, but such is the nature of being in the Herod family. So Claudius kind of transfers authority away from Fadus back into the Herod family. Okay. And he gives King Herod and Queen Bernice this position of power. He gives them that title, king and queen, which is something the Herods wanted desperately to have, this title, king and queen of Judea. And so they took up a residence in the holy city, and they commuted back and forth between Jerusalem and their kingdom of Chalcis. Herod of Chalcis immediately flexed his muscle by removing the current high priest from the office and bestowing that dignity on another person, a successor, a man named Joseph, the son of Commodus. So again, you have Rome removing a high priest, which according to the Torah, no one has the right to do that. And then Rome appointing a high priest, which again, according to the Torah, only that can only be done a certain way. For his part, Fadus proved himself, though, to be somewhat of a good administrator, at least from a secular point of view. He did restore a lot of peace, and he also put to death false messiahs. One such case is a Messiah candidate. Whenever Rome starts really hammering down on the Jews in Jerusalem, somebody comes up and says, I'm the Messiah, follow me and I'll deliver you. And then Rome has to kill that individual to show that wasn't your Messiah and we're still in charge. All right. And so there was an individual named Theudas who did this. And Josephus talks about this. This is what Josephus has to say about Theudas and the false Messiah Theudas. Josephus says, now it came to pass that while Theudas was the procurator of Judea, a certain magician, whose name was Theudas, persuaded a large number of people to take their belongings with them and follow him to the Jordan River. He there told them he was a prophet, and that he would split the river by his own words, allowing them an easy escape from Rome across it. Many were deceived by his words. However, Theudas did not permit them to test his wild claims. He sent a troop of Roman cavalry out against them. They took them by surprise, slew many of them, and others they took alive. They took Theudas alive, but then they cut off his head and carried it with them to Jerusalem to show everyone. And there ends Josephus' account of what he knows of Theudas. All right, so again, that's the political climate. That's what's going on when you think about when we get to Acts 15 and you see Peter and John and James, you know, and all that. This is what they're hearing about in the news. This is what they are seeing. This is what they are experiencing from the Roman government. After 2 years, Claudius fully replaces Theudas, and he appoints Tiberius Julius Alexander for the years 46 to 48 of the Common Era. Bernice's brother-in-law by her previous marriage to Marcus Julius Alexander, which is the son of Alexander of Alexandria, Egypt. And our good friend Philo of Alexandria was Tiberius's uncle. So all of this is a tight-knit family. Josephus knows all of this. Philo knows this. Philo's related to these people. These people are engaging the apostolic community. Individuals are finding their names showing up in our New Testament scriptures as well as in Roman history. All of this is going on together. Jerusalem, the council in Acts 15 isn't meeting in a vacuum any more than when, you know, a tragedy strikes in our nation and another state or in Noblesville, Indiana, things going on here, but that impacts us as we hear about it, and it shapes us, and it changes us. All right, so this is all going on. You may remember back in, I think, Acts 11, there was a prophet named Agabus who predicted a famine. And so Paul, whenever he would go out, would collect funds and so forth to help give relief to the saints in Jerusalem. The famine has reached its height now. Josephus even records, quote, under Theudas and Tiberius Alexander, the great famine happened in Judea. So you have Acts prophesying about it and then it occurring in Acts. That shows up in Paul's epistles when he talks about making a collection for the people back in Jerusalem. It's all related to this great famine. So the fact that we know when this great famine occurred helps us date parts of the New Testament that talk about the great famine happening. All right. And so Queen Helena brings grain and distributes it to those who are in want, Josephus says. In the year 48, King Herod of Chalcis appointed the wealthy and corrupt Sadducee Ananias, son of Nebadeus, to the high priesthood. So once again, you have Rome interfering in the priesthood and in the temple and in this worship services of the Jewish people. It was the last appointment that this particular king would make. Herod of Chalcis died that same year, which left his queen Bernice behind, twice widowed with two sons and 20 years old. The emperor granted her dead husband's small kingdom of Chalcis to her, and gave the sovereignty of the Temple Mount to finally Agrippa the Second. The young king then allowed his younger sister to remain and retain her title as queen. So that kind of gets us to the year 49. So all of those things happening in those 4 or 5 years has got the zealot movement kind of stirred up all again. So as Paul and Barnabas are continuing their work in Syria and Antioch, the events in Judea and in Jerusalem are tipping towards war. At the same time that Claudius gave the kingdom of Chalcis to Agrippa II, he sent an individual by the name of Ventidius Cumanus to take over the governorship of Judea, and in many ways to take over the old Pontius Pilate role. Josephus says this about it, quote, "Under Cumanus the troubles began, and the ruin of the Jews began to come upon them. Every year during the pilgrimage of the festivals of Passover, Shavuot, which is known as Pentecost, and Sukkot, which is known as Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths, worshippers from all over the world fled and filled Jerusalem. The large crowds obviously made the Romans nervous because this wasn't just a religious event for the Jewish people. You can't separate it also from their ethnic and national identity. So it no doubt flared up in them not only religious heights, but nationalistic heights. This is our land. This is our temple. We should be in control kind of feelings. And so the Romans would get nervous, and they routinely brought in extra troops to the fortress Antonio. And Josephus says, quote, "For they were always armed and kept guard at the festivals to try to prevent any insurrection which the crowds might decide to undertake," end quote. At Passover in the year 49, this is such a historic Passover that it makes its way into Roman history, as well as Josephus' history. But it's a known Passover. We've seen a couple of them. Obviously, Jesus and Passover is the biggest. But we've also seen in the book of Acts a couple of others. But this is another big one in the year 49. Cumanus established a detachment of soldiers to occupy the portico roof surrounding the temple complex in order to overlook its court. So he basically put armed soldiers where the priests should be standing in order to be singing and playing their instruments and welcoming people into the courts of the Lord. Those have been pushed aside, and now you have armed military there. So imagine you're going to worship at one of your most sacred holidays, and an oppressive foreign government has removed your religious things and has placed its army fully armed, staring at you with guns and the red dot on your head as you go about your business. It would probably upset you. It would probably aggravate you and make you angry. And if you tended to be one of the more militant in the family, it might make you become a true zealot, to the point of deciding you're going to do something about it. So that's the tension. All right. So instead of the Temple Mount being filled with priests singing and playing instruments, it's filled with armed soldiers. Okay. And then it's then what happens is on Passover is a 7-day festival. On the fourth day of the festival, a large number of worshipers choked the temple courts. Again, this is one of the reasons it's great if you ever, by God's grace, are allowed to go to Israel. Even today, you can get a sense of this when you walk through these crowded streets of Jerusalem. However crowded it was when you went, I want you to multiply it by 50. And that's what it's like in a first century Passover setting. All right. You aren't moving. And you know there are those times where it just gets really bogged down and choked, and you just almost get claustrophobic. Well, this happens, this is always what makes Rome nervous when that kind of thing happens. And, of course, many disciples of Jesus were there. Followers of the Jesus movement were there. But during the time of sacrifice and prayer, one of the Roman soldiers in the temple pulled back his garment and bent over in an indecent manner. Now, he turned his buttocks towards the crowd, toward the worshipers. And in case you ever think reading Josephus and history is boring, you do get to come across these passages that I will briefly hold up here. This is a quote from Josephus, so it's a historical source, all right? So the soldier bends over, you know which way he's facing, to the worshipers, and Josephus says this, and he made such noises as you might expect upon such a posture. You like how Josephus said that in a nice way? Now, this is Passover. This is in the temple. This is during the sacrifice. And this is a foreign, pagan, oppressive, invading military person in your place of worship, all right, who does this. So, as you can imagine, the indecent affront to the sanctity of the temple immediately set off a riot in the temple courts. The younger hotheads in the crowd began to pelt the soldiers with stones. Cumanus, the Pontius Pilate of the day, reacted quickly and dispatched additional troops from the fortress Antonia. When the thousands of worshippers in the temple saw the coming onslaught, they panicked and made a rush for the exits. You could think sometimes is what you see in European soccer when they've had people literally crushed to death, when it's just such a sea and a mass of people trying to exit in a hurry. Crowds trying to press their way again down these very narrow tunnels and streets towards the southern gates. So hundreds would have been crushed underfoot. Josephus records this, quote, "The violence with which they crowded to the escape was so great that they trod upon one another, crushing one another, until 10,000 were dead." That's according to Josephus. Whether you counted them or not, I don't know. I don't know if that's a literal number. All I can know is that number doesn't have to be inflated because it's Passover. It's the sacrifice time of Passover. It's not a problem that there would be that many people, not only on the Temple Mount, but in the whole surrounding area where if there was a mass Roman onslaught, that such could occur. But that's what Josephus records. And so the remaining 3 days of Passover, which is normally a joyous and glad festival, was turned into a time of mourning. The burning of a Torah scroll. A second injury insulted the nation under Cumanus, again the Pontius Pilate of the day. While conducting a police action in the region of Beit Horon, a soldier seized a Torah scroll. He publicly tore the scroll to pieces and then tossed it into a fire. The Mishnah actually records of this incident when it lists 5 things that are remembered on the fast of the 4th month. So in Judaism, there are 5 fast days. Yom Kippur is obviously the most famous, but it's only one of 5. There's Tisha B'Av, there's the fast of Gedaliah. There's also this particular one that's known as Tammuz 17, the 17th day of the month of Tammuz, which is in the 4th day. There are 5 things that are remembered on this fast, that call for the fast. The Mishnah says in Ta'anit, chapter 4 in the first Mishnah, it says, 5 calamities happened to our ancestors on the 17th day of the month of Tammuz. Moses broke the tablets of the Holy Law. The continual daily offerings ceased when Jerusalem was seized by Nebuchadnezzar. The walls of Jerusalem were breached by Nebuchadnezzar. Apostamas burned the scroll of the Torah. So the Mishnah even gives this soldier a name. And then it gives the 5th, an idol was placed in the temple in the days of King Manasseh. Outraged by the sacrilege, the nation cried out against the procurator and the Roman army. An angry mob marches to Caesarea by the sea, and Cumanus narrowly averts an insurrection by having the guilty soldier publicly executed. All right, so that's some of what's going on. But what's going on in Rome, way back in Rome and in the Roman Empire. And this also, again, helps us with background for the epistle to the Romans. So at the same time all of these things are happening in Jerusalem, the Jewish residents of Rome are experiencing their own trials. So Paul's been up in Galatia. The guys in Jerusalem have been going through what we just talked about as Paul is making his way back down. And then there are the Jewish people, both the Jewish believers in Jesus, as well as the Jewish individuals who don't believe in Jesus. But back in Rome, the Jewish community in Rome, they're going through their own trials. According to one common Christian tradition, which is a myth that we're going to bust today, there is a Christian tradition that says Peter and Paul founded the church in Rome. That's not biblical. All right, that's not biblical. They did not found the church in Rome. In reality, faith in Jesus came to Rome long before. Scripture itself testifies to this back in Acts chapter 2, verse 10, where it says, visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, they came for Shavuot, Pentecost, heard first the good news at Pentecost, in the year that Jesus rose, and they carried that message back with them to Rome. We also will see that Paul knows and sends people to Rome before he ever goes to Rome. All right, so Jesus is in Rome before Peter and Paul ever get to Rome. The Clementine homilies, the Clementine literature, again, I've talked about that quite a bit in the Chronicles of the Apostles. Clement was a disciple of the Apostle Peter. He also knew John and the other apostles, but he was primarily a disciple of Peter. He writes quite a bit. In fact, he writes to the Corinthians, and he writes to the Ephesians, and he sees himself as the predecessor, the one who follows up, takes Peter's position, if you will. He takes over. He's second generation Jesus community leader. Second generation leader who knew first generation leaders such as Peter. And Clement tells us about early apostolic emissaries, believers in Jesus, arriving in Rome and teaching the good news within the first decade of Jesus' resurrection. So by the time Paul writes the book of Romans, the epistle to the Romans, he's not yet visited Rome. Obviously, Paul cannot take credit for planting the gospel there, but he knows the people who did. In his epistle to the Romans, he sent greetings to Andronicus, Junius, who ministered in Rome, as well as a host of other Roman Jewish believers. By the time the gospel arrived in Rome, the Jewish community itself had already been rooted there for nearly seven decades. So we need to remember the context of the time again. Two things the New Testament church doesn't have: a New Testament and a church. So where is the church meeting? They're meeting in the synagogues. They're part of the Jewish community. That's still the case. Yes, there comes a time in history where that's not the case. But this is the case now. Right? This helps us. That will help us in the epistle to Romans when we realize when Paul writes to the Romans, he is writing to the Jewish community, both the Jewish community that does not accept Jesus, the Jewish community that does accept Jesus, and the God-fearing Gentiles who have attached themselves to faith in Jesus, therefore grafted into Abraham, and also, before that, were no doubt, as we've seen in the book of Acts, they were connected to the Jewish community in the synagogue. And so, at the time of the New Testament writing, the Jesus community looked like this. When they gathered for worship, they were worshiping with God-fearing Gentiles, Jesus-following Jews, and Jews who didn't believe in Jesus. They were all together in one congregation. Right? That's the context. All right? This is who Paul is writing to. Who is the weaker brother in Romans? It's the Jew who doesn't believe. Who's the stronger brother? It's the Jew who does believe. Who are those who observe different days and so forth? That's the God-fearers among them who are coming in from a completely different background. All right? And the one who bears the sword, it's not talking about the government and the local government. Do you know that's an idiom? In the Jewish community, the one who bears the sword is the one who circumcises. That's his title. That's his title. And so Paul is saying, look, when you're in this community, you respect your authorities. You respect the Beit Din. Even if they're weaker than you. Because they bear the sword. They sit in the seat of Moses, is the way Jesus would have said it in the Gospel of Matthew. Right? And so that's the context. Too often, we read a post-16th century context back into Rome, assuming that there's this established church and it's completely thriving and separate from the Jewish community and it's full of nothing but Gentiles and all that. That is displacement. That is taking a current understanding of reality and saying that must have been the case back then, and so we're going to interpret as if all those words were written as if that's the situation. That wasn't the situation. The New Testament doesn't describe the situation as that. The New Testament describes it as they're all together. And hopefully, as we've gone through Acts, I've been very intentional in pointing that out. Where's the first place Paul goes to? Synagogue. Why? Because that's where the God-fearers are, the God-fearing Gentiles are. And what happens when he gets there? Many Jews believe in the message of Jesus. They're not rejecting, and those who don't, they're not rejecting Jesus, and they're not rejecting Paul because of Jesus, but because of these other issues, right? But they're all together in one community. There is no distinct identity of the church yet. Does it happen? Yes, it happens. Clearly it happens. We're here, right? But it's not happened yet. It's too early. It's too organic right now. It's too fluid right now. That's part of what the Jerusalem Council is for. Because it's so fluid, because it's so organic, because it's so, quite frankly, crazy, right? This all sounds crazy, right? There had to be something that said, okay, look, we've got to get some order in this. Like, what does the community like this look like? How do we function, right? Ultimately, that's what Acts 15 is going to give some guidance for, especially now that Paul has gone up and through Galatia and he's done all those things up in the Galatia region that we've just covered. Word of that from Jewish communities there is getting back to Jewish communities in Jerusalem, either as one travels up there or one travels down here. But things are now starting to spread as things would spread even now. And it's causing confusion, and it's causing chaos, and it's causing concern, and it's causing worry. And atop all of that, you have all these other external things that are adding fuel to all of that fire, right? So now you may understand why the Jews who weren't embracing the God-fearers were a little sensitive, right? Because you're seeing what's going on in the culture around them. They're fearing that at any moment, Rome's going to decide, we don't need Jewish people anymore. We don't need them and we don't want them. And so from their perspective, they're holding on to that identity and what it means to be that and the traditions and all as tight as they can. I mean, Rome's already appointing and displacing their priests, governing their worship services, doing all these horrible things in the temple, putting idols in there and what we've read about earlier. Imagine how sensitive they would be to anything changing their status quo and their normal, right? And so all of this is kind of going on. It's crazy times. And it's setting the scene now for James as the head of the Jesus community now, rooted in Jerusalem, to say, all right, let's outline some things to look at. How will this look? How do Gentiles fit into our community? What does it really mean? Because Paul has already gone once to James and the apostles in Jerusalem, but that was more of a private meeting. That was more of a Paul, as we talked about going there, saying, I don't want to run in vain. I want to make sure that my gospel is apostolic stamped and approved. And not only did the apostles say it's good to go, but they even gave him the title of apostle. They accepted him into the brotherhood. But that was more much more privatized, all right? And so what's needed now on a bigger scale is something like that for everyone to hear, accept, and follow. All right. So all of this is getting us ready for the Acts 15 account. Philo describes the Jewish community in Rome like this. The great section of Rome, which is on the other side of the Tiber River, was occupied and inhabited by Jews. They were mostly Roman citizens, emancipated slaves, who were brought to Italy as captives by Pompey around 63 BC, by the way. And they were freed by those who had bought them for slaves. Now, this should sound familiar because this is the story of Paul, right? When we talked way back when, Acts chapter 9, how did Paul have Roman citizenship, right? Well, we looked at the synagogue of the freedmen, was also known as the synagogue of those from Tarshish. Tarshish, Paul's hometown, was a known Roman colony where Roman slave owners freed their Jewish slaves. And part of that was they got certain benefits of Roman citizenship, right? And so Philo describes that this is the case in Rome, that the Jewish community in Rome, they're Jewish, but they also have Roman citizenship because they are the descendants of that mass freeing of Jewish slaves that occurred around 60 BC. It says, Philo continues to say this, quote, they had synagogues, they attended them regularly, especially on the holy days and the Sabbath, and they regularly contributed sums of money from their first fruits to send to Jerusalem by the hands of those who were to go and to pay for the sacrifices for them. So they had an active Jewish community that continued its connection to Jerusalem. Like the followers of Jesus and other Jewish communities, the believers in Rome would have still been connected to the Jewish community. That split has not occurred yet. That split does not happen until 135 AD. John Damascene writes this, quote, many from among the Jews had believed in Jesus, but they still held in their conscience the law and faith, and they kept the observance of foods and so forth. As their numbers grew, they began to attract more God-fearing Gentiles from the Roman people. It seems history would let us know, not just the New Testament accounts, but history in general, and Seleucianists and other Roman historians. Around this period, a lot of Roman citizens began a fascination with monotheism, and as well as an attraction to the ethics and the morality of the Torah, the Bible. All right. And so Rome, the Jewish community there, attracts a large following of these God-fearers. In the 4th century, all right, so after the split has happened and when both sides get nasty towards one another, a Christian writer, Ambrosiaster, unhappily concedes that the first Gentile converts in the 1st century in Rome were in fact not only linked to the Jewish community, but were Torah observant. For him, this is bad news, by the way, but this is 4th century. This is what Ambrosiaster writes, quote, there were Jews living in Rome in the time of the apostles, 1st century. And those Jews who had believed passed on to the Romans, the Gentiles, the tradition that they ought to profess Jesus as the Messiah, but also continue to obey the law. They certainly accepted faith in Jesus as Christ, but they also lived according to the Jewish way. Those who led the Romans to faith had it all mixed up, Ambrosiaster says, because according to faith they were Christian, according to practice they were Jews. And that is his description of first century Roman community of Jesus followers. That's the community Paul is writing to, right? All right, a community that has all of this stuff kind of going on in it. By the year 47, so many Romans had adapted faith in Jesus that the Emperor Claudius complained to the Senate about, quote, the growth of the foreign superstition. leading to the neglect of the observance of the Roman religion, namely Caesar worship and so forth. In the year 49, a series of disruptions and civil unrest gave Claudius an excuse to take out action against these foreign superstitions. The Roman historian Suetonius writes, quote, "Since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of the man called Christus, he expelled them from Rome," end quote. Now, what is pretty obvious here, and which is pretty much universally agreed upon in the scholarly community, is that Suetonius, a Roman historian, a well-respected Roman historian, mistook the title Christus, Messiah, if you will, as a person's name. And so he says that, describing 49, again, 49 over in Jerusalem, you've got that disastrous Passover. 49 in Rome, you have Claudius taking out actions against the Jews who are instigated by Christus, by Messiah. So, and there are other writings that Suetonius says that are pretty fascinating. In fact, in my book, How Firm a Foundation, I quote much of Suetonius in there. Suetonius thought all Christians were Jewish. He thought they were a Jewish sect because of how they lived their life. But he kept saying, but they keep following this guy named Christus. He never figured out Christus wasn't like a dude that was living with them, but he thought that. He kept saying this Christus guy is taking these Jews all over the place. But again, that's first century, authentic first century testimony of what that community looked like. For Suetonius, a complete outsider, complete Roman, pagan, Caesar-worshipping outsider, Christians were Jews following a dude named Christus. All right? That's the context of Romans, folks. That's the context of Romans. So what kind of disturbances, though, could these believers have made at the instigation of this Christus, this Messiah? It seems that these disturbances would have been arguments between the believers, the Jewish believers, and the God-fearing believers, and the rest of the Jewish community, which is what Paul is trying to address in Romans, by the way. The clash created such a ruckus in the synagogues and the Jewish community that it became concerning. It's doubtful that Claudius would have cared a whole lot about this, but at the same time, he knows what's going on because he's friends with Agrippa II, what's going on over there in Judea, and he knows the two communities are linked and they are tight. It would cause him to have a little bit of concern. Maybe loosely related to this, a modern way of thinking about it is, We might think of something of the name like ISIS as being in Syria and Lebanon and so forth, Afghanistan. But if we heard there was an ISIS chapter in Indianapolis, we would hope that those who are officials would look into that and not just go, that's over there problem, right? Well, over there is connected to over here, all right? And as we've established, as Philo established, as Josephus has established, as Suetonius establishes, the Jewish community in Rome does connect with the Jewish community in Jerusalem. They send funds back and forth. They support one another. They travel back and forth. So if one's having issues, Claudius might be concerned if something's going on in his local community as well. The disturbances also at this instigation of this man named Christus could also refer to the proselytizing of Roman Gentiles, of Roman citizens who are fully participating in the Roman religions and polytheism and gods and the temples and bending the knee to Caesar as divine. Well, more and more of these individuals, including those who are senators and high-ranking officials, such as Sergius Paulus, are becoming believers. All right, and this kind of causes a problem, because if you're Caesar, part of your authority is bent on the fact that everyone serving in your Senate thinks you're divine. Right? And well, if that kind of gets undermined and they realize you're not divine and you're not that special, in fact, as the case with Nero, you might be totally crazy and insane, that really does cause a problem. And so Claudius may have been concerned as more and more Roman officials are turning from their paganism, which again was something quite common in this period. Part of Paul, when he says at just the right time, the Pax Romana, I bring forth my son, you know, God brings forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. It's not just of the superhighway system and the small world that Rome had created, but also there was something in the Roman spirit where they had grown weary and disenchanted with the Roman religious system, and particularly its ethics and its morality. And so they were white for the harvest, if you will. All right. And so Claudius is seeing this, which is a threat to him, and it is a threat to his way of ruling and so forth. Luke even claims in Acts chapter 18, verse 2, Claudius commands all the Jews to leave Rome. Perhaps Claudius expelled the Jews who did not have Roman citizenship, and consequently the edict would affect Jews and possibly the God-fearing Gentiles who were living like Jews, as Suetonius says. The Romans defined Jews not merely in ethnic terms, but included those who lived like they did. And this becomes something that St. Augustine wants to break from with Rome. When Rome, by the time of St. Augustine, gets really fed up with the Jewish community, Augustine wants to say, and many in Rome officially are still viewing Christianity as a Jewish sect, Augustine wants to say, oh, no, 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 no. And Jerome does this even before Augustine. Oh, no, 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 no. We're not part of it. You don't persecute us. When you persecute the Jews, leave us alone. We're not like them. And then Jerome goes to this whole thing where he parallels Apollo to Jesus and so forth to try to stab the Romans. Leave them alone, right? And this is where all that split and stuff starts happening, all right? But right now, this is what's happening. And there happens to be a Jew in Rome at this time named Pontus. From Pontus, named Aquila, and his wife Priscilla, right? They show up in Romans. They made their living in Rome as tent makers. They were among the earliest disciples of Jesus in Rome. So Peter and Paul didn't establish a church there. But they did not have Roman citizenship. So when the edict of Claudius came, that's described in Acts 18, they left the city and relocated to the city of Corinth. All right. So, I think we can look at the first verse of Acts 15. And as we do so, don't only keep all of this in mind, but keep in mind Acts 11 through 14. Because we've not only looked at these specific events, but again, this stuff does not happen in a vacuum. All right? In 1950, parents probably weren't nervous when their kids went to high school. They probably didn't fear that they might not come home alive. We now have that as a real fear. We now have the idea of not if it's going to happen in our school, but when it's going to happen in our school, right? Knowing what's going on helps you understand the culture, right? Because it changes them and it affects them, right? And so when this group meets in Jerusalem, it's got all of these other factors. They're not just meeting in isolation, wanting to establish nice theological truths and doctrines, as so often the church teaches it, as if they're these clerical collar-wearing, robe-wearing bishops with mitres sitting around establishing the doctrine of the church. No. No. They're dealing with all this stuff we just talked about, right? And they're trying to figure out, what do we do? Like, what is this? Right? So all of these sitzim leben, these cultural contexts we've been establishing, just keep them in mind. So Acts chapter 15, verse 1. But some men came down from Judea and were teaching the brothers, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Their phrase there, you cannot be saved, is not, again, the theological way we understand salvation now. From a Jewish point of view, even now, by the way, but especially in the first century, salvation meant being connected to and part of the covenant and connected to the land of Israel. That is salvation to a Jew. It means you are part of the covenant God made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that you are connected to that covenant, and you are connected to that covenant through the land of Israel. That's why when you mess with Israel, they get all upset, because it's tied to their salvation. I'm not telling you that's the truth. I'm telling you that's the belief of the Jewish people. And so when they say, unless you're circumcised, you can't be saved, they don't mean that phrase the way 16th century Dr. Martin Luther heard them say that phrase, or the way you hear them say that phrase. They said, you cannot be part of the covenant God gave to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob unless you be circumcised. That's what they're saying. For them, covenant was salvation. What was the mark of the covenant? How did one become part of the covenant according to the Torah? Circumcision, right? So that's what they're saying. They're saying they weren't denying you couldn't be part of it. They're saying if you want to be part of it, if you want to be grafted in, right? If you want to be grafted in, you have to go through what Abraham went through and what Isaac went through and what Jacob went through and what Moses went through and and everyone that's followed. You have to go through the circumcision to be saved. All right? This isn't about forgiveness of sins. This isn't about resurrection from the dead. Salvation doesn't mean that in this context. Does it mean that in other contexts? Yes, it does. It doesn't mean that in this context, right? The increasing number of Gentile disciples continue to raise concerns. And although Paul had already acquired his apostolic endorsement for his gospel that we talked about beginning in Acts 11 and went through 12, 13, and 14, he had done so largely, as Galatians 2 and verse 2 says, in private to those who were of reputation, end quote. So Paul lets us know that first meeting was largely a small meeting. It wasn't a public forum. It wasn't a diet, if you will. It wasn't something for the masses. It was something so that he knew he wasn't running in vain, and so that when he went to these other places, he could then cite or bring with him letters of endorsement saying that this is apostolic approved. So Paul has done this, but it's catching a lot of momentum. The majority of the Jewish believers did not know about this meeting or the results of this meeting. And so they were still insisting on, in order to be a Jesus follower, you had to become a Jew. You had to become a Jew in order to follow Jesus, right? That was their thinking, because they have not yet heard the full thing. It happened during those days that some disciples came from Judea to visit the community in Syria, Antioch. They belonged to, as Acts 15 verse 5 says, a sect of the Pharisees who had believed. So here's you some biblical proof that the Pharisees did not reject Jesus. All right? Some did and some didn't. All right? There were Pharisees who did believe. Acts 15 verse 5. They were teaching the God-fearing Gentiles. All right, they weren't saying, oh, Messiah is not for you, or, oh, no, you can't become part of us. But they were saying, again, because of their ethnicity and all of that background we've established, you need to become fully like us, right? No different than the 1700s when German Lutherans settled in Michigan and said, Native Americans, we love you, but you're going to need to learn German so that we can teach you the small catechism in German so that you can then worship and sing our hymns in German with us. That's all. That doesn't seem so unreasonable, does it? Right? Right? That's their background, right? So it's like saying, look, if you want our Messiah, that's great. You want our Torah, you want our scriptures, you want our morality, you want our way of life, you want our connections, you want all these things. Great. He is the God of all. Become one of us, and there you go, right? And so that's what they were teaching, a certain section of them. Paul had only recently composed his epistle to the God-fearers in Galatia, which, as we've seen, is a long apologetic for the existence of Gentile believers, and that they are grafted in by grace and through faith. And Paul does, as we see, maintain one aspect of Jewish conversion, though, baptism. Part of the full Jewish conversion was a baptism. So we have retained some of it, folks, all right? By grace through faith, with its chief marker being that of baptism. So it's very possible that word about the contents of Paul's epistle and Paul's time in Galatia is making its way around to various communities, and word is getting back to Jerusalem. The men from Jerusalem seem to have come deliberately to challenge Paul's work. Obviously, they knew about the dispute in Paul's gospel, and they may have been connected with Galatians 2:12, certain men from James that we talked about, who visited the community a few years earlier. They came to press their case for how Gentiles are to become part of the Jesus community. They weren't arguing that they couldn't become a part of it. The debate was, how do they? And this is a legitimate issue, because up until this point, it's really never been an issue for the Jewish people, right? The God-fearers just kind of grafted on and just kind of leached on the society. Never before had sermons been directed to Gentiles. Never before had they really converted in mass. So this was a new problem. One of those that we might even say, this is a good problem to have, right? Like a couple of weeks ago, we ran out of communion wafers and communion wine, and we still had 250 people left to commune, right? So we sat there for probably 3 minutes, but it felt like 25 or 30 minutes, right? And just kind of sat there like, man, this is awkward. Like, you know, and people are wondering, like, why aren't they communing? Is this a whole table full of sinners that we're excommunicating and we're about to announce their sin? You know, all of this. And again, by the way, it was only like 3 minutes and our altar people did perfectly fine. But how I kind of passed the time was I said, you know what? This is a good problem to have when more people come for communion than you expected. In many ways, this is a good problem for the community. Yeah, it's caused some heated debate and so forth, but it's all revolving around Gentiles coming to the true knowledge of who God is, the one true God is, and wanting to connect to God through the Messiah. This is a great thing. What does that look like? Well, I mean, for us, it's a no-brainer. But you've had 2,000 years of people paving the way and knocking down the walls for you, right? And so for them, this is new. And so with anything new, there are bumps in the road. There are bumps in the road, right? So also keep that in mind. It's not just nasty, hate-filled stuff. It's passionate. And people have sides, and people have opinions, but it's a good problem to have because it means people are coming to faith in Messiah, especially God-fearers and Gentiles. Those who otherwise would have been forever outside of this are now becoming vital insiders by grace and through faith in Jesus as their Messiah. So all they're wanting to know is, how do we worship together now? Do we speak Hebrew together? Do we worship in Hebrew? Do we worship in the native language? Does it matter what tongue? That's the whole tongues thing. Like, should they have, you know, who can preach? Who can be an elder? Who can speak? These are all just questions that have to be addressed, and people are going to have opinions, right? Until it gets worked out. And so they're all there trying to work this out. Here we are in Acts 15, the first verse, a group has come and they've shown some issue with what we've already seen congregations have issue with. It's not the Jewish response to Jesus that's the issue. It's not the Gentile response to Jesus that's the issue. It's the Jewish response to the Gentile issue that's the issue. And that's because it's never existed before. And so it's tough. It's tough. And now it's playing out on a true large scale in Acts 15. So with that, now that I've kept you to 5 minutes before worship, because I don't have to be there, all right, we will close with a blessing. Baruch atah Adonai, notein hadavar. Blessed are you, Lord God, who has given to us the gift of the Scriptures. Amen.